Redactor's note. This is volume 4 of the 5 volume of an edition of the works of Poe. The only figure is that of the chess automaton and Maelzel's chess player. There are several Greek words. The works of Edgar Allan Poe in 5 volumes, volume 4. Contents, the devil in the belfry lionizing exigne paragrab metzengerstein the system of Dr. Tarr and Professor Feather the literary life of Thingambob Esquire. How to write a Blackwood article a predicament mystification diddling the angel of the odd Melonia tata the ductalom let the oblong box loss of breath the man that was used up the businessman the landscape garden Maelzel's chess player the power of words the colloquy of Mona's and Una the conversation of arrows and Charmian shadow. A parable, equals, the devil in the belfry, what o'clock is it? Old saying. Everybody knows, in a general way, that the finest place in the world is, or, alas, was the Dutch borough of Van der Vadimidis. Yet as it lies some distance from any of the main roads, being in a somewhat out-of-the-way situation, there are perhaps very few of my readers who have ever paid it a visit. For the benefit of those who have not, therefore, it will be only proper that I should enter into some account of it. And this is indeed the more necessary, as with the hope of enlisting public sympathy in behalf of the inhabitants, I design here to give a history of the calamitous events which have so lately occurred within its limits. No one who knows me will doubt that the duty thus self-imposed will be executed to the best of my ability, with all that rigid impartiality, all that cautious examination into facts, and diligent collation of authorities, which should ever distinguish him who aspires to the title of historian. By the united aid of medals, manuscripts, and inscriptions, I am enabled to say, positively, that the borough of Van der Vadimidis has existed, from its origin, in precisely the same condition which it at present preserves. Of the date of this origin, however, I grieve that I can only speak with that species of indefinite definiteness which mathematicians are, at times, forced to put up with in certain algebraic formulae. The date, I may thus say, in regard to the remoteness of its antiquity, cannot be less than any assignable quantity whatsoever. Touching the derivation of the name Van der Vadimidis, I confess myself, with sorrow, equally at fault. Among a multitude of opinions upon this delicate point, some acute, some learned, some sufficiently the reverse, I am able to select nothing which ought to be considered satisfactory. Perhaps the idea of Grogzwig nearly coincident with that of Crowd of Plenty is to be cautiously preferred. It runs. Van der Vadimidis van der, leached under Vadimidis, quasi unbleetses bleetses opsel, pro blitzen. This derivative, to say the truth, is still countenanced by some traces of the electric fluid evident on the summit of the steeple of the house of the town council. I do not choose, however, to commit myself on a theme of such importance, and must refer the reader desirous of information to the Radiuncule de Rebus Praeter Veteris, of Dundergetz. See, also, Blunder Buzzard e Derivationibus, pages 27-50, 10 folio, Gothic edit. Red and black character, catchword and no cipher. Wherein consult, also, marginal notes in the autograph of Stuff and Puff, with the sub-commentaries of Grunt and Juzzle. Notwithstanding the obscurity which thus envelops the date of the foundation of Van der Vadimidis, and the derivation of its name, there can be no doubt, as I said before, that it has always existed as we find it at this epoch. The oldest man in the borough can remember not the slightest difference in the appearance of any portion of it, and, indeed, the very suggestion of such a possibility is considered an insult. The site of the village is in a perfectly circular valley, about a quarter of a mile in circumference, and entirely surrounded by gentle hills, over whose summit the people have never yet ventured to pass. For this they assign the very good reason, that they do not believe there is anything at all on the other side. Round the skirts of the valley, which is quite level, and paved throughout with flat tiles, extends a continuous row of 60 little houses. These, having their backs on the hills, must look, of course, to the center of the plain, which is just 60 yards from the front door of each dwelling. Every house has a small garden before it, with a circular path, a sundial, and 24 cabbages. The buildings themselves are so precisely alike that one can in no manner be distinguished from the other. Owing to the vast antiquity, the style of architecture is somewhat odd, but it is not for that reason the less strikingly picturesque. They are fashioned of hard-burned little bricks, red, with black ends, so that the walls look like a chessboard upon a great scale. The gables are turned to the front, and there are cornices, as big as all the rest of the house, over the eaves, and over the main doors. The windows are narrow and deep, with very tiny panes and a great deal of sash. On the roof is a vast quantity of tiles with long curly ears. The woodwork, throughout, is of a dark hue and there is much carving about it, with but a trifling variety of pattern for time out of mind. The carvers of Van der Vadimidis have never been able to carve more than two objects, a timepiece and a cabbage. But these they do exceedingly well, and intersperse them, with singular ingenuity, wherever they find room for the chisel. The dwellings are as much alike inside as out, and the furniture is all upon one plan. The floors are of square tiles, the chairs and tables of black-looking wood with thin crooked legs and puppy feet. The mantelpieces are wide and high, and have not only timepieces and cabbages sculptured over the front, but a real timepiece, which makes a prodigious ticking, on the top in the middle, with a flower pot containing a cabbage standing on each extremity by way of outrider. Between each cabbage and the timepiece, again, is a little Chinaman having a large stomach with a great round hole in it, through which is seen the dial plate of a watch. The fireplaces are large and deep, with fierce crooked-looking fire dogs. There is constantly a rousing fire, and a huge pot over it, full of sauerkraut and pork, to which the good woman of the house is always busy in attending. She is a little fat old lady, with blue eyes and a red face, and wears a huge cap like a sugar loaf, ornamented with purple and yellow ribbons. Her dress is of orange-colored linsey-woolsey, made very full behind and very short in the waist, and indeed very short in other respects, not reaching below the middle of her leg. This is somewhat thick, and so are her ankles, but she has a fine pair of green stockings to cover them. Her shoes of pink leather are fastened each with a bunch of yellow ribbons puckered up in the shape of a cabbage. In her left hand she has a little heavy Dutch watch. In her right she wields a ladle for the sauerkraut and pork. By her side there stands a fat tabby cat, with a gilt toy repeater tied to its tail, which the boys have there fastened by way of a quiz. The boys themselves are, all three of them, in the garden attending the pig. They are each 2 feet in height. They have three-cornered cocked hats, purple waistcoats reaching down to their thighs, buckskin knee breeches, red stockings, heavy shoes with big silver buckles, long surtout coats with large buttons of mother of pearl. Each too has a pipe in his mouth, and a little dumpy watch in his right hand. He takes a puff and a look, and then a look and a puff. The pig, which is corpulent and lazy, is occupied now in picking up the stray leaves that fall from the cabbages, and now in giving a kick behind at the gilt repeater, which the urchins have also tied to his tail in order to make him look as handsome as the cat. Right at the front door, in a high-backed leather-bottomed armchair, with crooked legs and puppy feet like the tables, is seated the old man of the house himself. He is an exceedingly puffy little old gentleman, with big circular eyes and a huge double chin. His dress resembles that of the boys and I need say nothing farther about it. All the difference is that his pipe is somewhat bigger than theirs and he can make a greater smoke. Like them, he has a watch, but he carries his watch in his pocket. To say the truth, he has something of more importance than a watch to attend to, and what that is, I shall presently explain. He sits with his right leg upon his left knee, wears a grave countenance, and always keeps one of his eyes, at least, resolutely bent upon a certain remarkable object in the center of the plain. This object is situated in the steeple of the house of the town council. The town council are all very little, round, oily, intelligent men, with big saucer eyes and fat double chins, and have their coats much longer, and their shoe buckles much bigger than the ordinary inhabitants of Vondervotteimittis. Since my sojourn in the borough, they have had several special meetings, and have adopted these three important resolutions. That it is wrong to alter the good old course of things. That there is nothing tolerable out of Vondervotteimittis. And that we will stick by our clocks and our cabbages. Above the session room of the council is the steeple, and in the steeple is the belfry, where exists, and has existed time out of mind, the pride and wonder of the village, the great clock of the borough of Vondervotteimittis. And this is the object to which the eyes of the old gentlemen are turned who sit in the leather-bottomed armchairs. The great clock has seven faces, one in each of the seven sides of the steeple, so that it can be readily seen from all quarters. Its faces are large and white, and its hands heavy and black. There is a belfry man whose sole duty is to attend to it, but this duty is the most perfect of sinecures, for the clock of Vondervotteimittis was never yet known to have anything the matter with it. Until lately, the bare supposition of such a thing was considered heretical. From the remotest period of antiquity to which the archives have reference, the hours have been regularly struck by the big bell. And, indeed, the case was just the same with all the other clocks and watches in the borough. Never was such a place for keeping the true time. When the large clapper thought proper to say 12 o'clock, all its obedient followers opened their throats simultaneously, and responded like a very echo. In short, the good burghers were fond of their sauerkraut, but then they were proud of their clocks. All people who hold sinecure offices are held in more or less respect, and as the belfry man of Vondervotteimittis has the most perfect of sinecures, he is the most perfectly respected of any man in the world. He is the chief dignitary of the borough, and the very pigs look up to him with a sentiment of reverence. His coattail is very far longer, his pipe, his shoe buckles, his eyes, and his stomach, very far bigger than those of any other old gentleman in the village, and as to his chin, it is not only double, but triple. I have thus painted the happy estate of Vondervotteimittis. Alas, that so fair a picture should ever experience a reverse. There has been long a saying among the wisest inhabitants, that oh good can come from over the hills, and it really seemed that the words had in them something of the spirit of prophecy. It wanted 5 minutes of noon, on the day before yesterday, when there appeared a very odd-looking object on the summit of the ridge of the eastward. Such an occurrence, of course, attracted universal attention, and every little old gentleman who sat in a leather-bottomed armchair turned one of his eyes with a stare of dismay upon the phenomenon, still keeping the other upon the clock in the steeple. By the time that it wanted only 3 minutes to noon, the droll object in question was perceived to be a very diminutive foreign-looking young man. He descended the hills at a great rate, so that everybody had soon a good look at him. He was really the most finicky little personage that had ever been seen in Vondervotteimittis. His countenance was of a dark snuff color, and he had a long hooked nose, pea eyes, a wide mouth, and an excellent set of teeth, which latter he seemed anxious of displaying, as he was grinning from ear to ear. What with mustachios and whiskers, there was none of the rest of his face to be seen. His head was uncovered, and his hair neatly done up in papillotes. His dress was a tight-fitting swallow-tailed black coat, from one of whose pockets dangled a vast length of white handkerchief, black kerseymere knee breeches, black stockings, and stumpy-looking pumps, with huge bunches of black satin ribbon for bows. Under one arm he carried a huge chapeau de bras, and under the other a fiddle nearly 5 times as big as himself. In his left hand was a gold snuff box, from which, as he capered down the hill, cutting all manner of fantastic steps, he took snuff incessantly with an air of the greatest possible self-satisfaction. God bless me! Here was a sight for the honest burghers of Vondervotteimittis. To speak plainly, the fellow had, in spite of his grinning, an audacious and sinister kind of face, and as he curveted right into the village, the old stumpy appearance of his pumps excited no little suspicion, and many a burgher who beheld him that day would have given a trifle for a peep beneath the white cambric handkerchief which hung so obtrusively from the pocket of his swallow-tailed coat. But what mainly occasioned a righteous indignation was, that the scoundrelly popinjay, while he cut a fandango here, and a whirligig there, did not seem to have the remotest idea in the world of such a thing as keeping time in his steps. The good people of the borough had scarcely a chance, however, to get their eyes thoroughly open, when, just as it wanted half a minute of noon, the rascal bounced, as I say, right into the midst of them, gave a chasses here, and a balances there, and then, after a pirouette and a pause de zephyr, pigeon-winged himself right up into the belfry of the house of the town council, where the wonder-stricken belfry man sat smoking in a state of dignity and dismay. But the little chap seized him at once by the nose, gave it a swing and a pull, clapped the big chapeau de bras upon his head, knocked it down over his eyes and mouth, and then, lifting up the big fiddle, beat him with it so long and so soundly, that what with the belfry man being so fat, and the fiddle being so hollow, you would have sworn, that there was a regiment of double bass drummers all beating the devil's tattoo up in the belfry of the steeple of Vondervotteimittis. There is no knowing to what desperate act of vengeance this unprincipled attack might have aroused the inhabitants. But for the important fact, that it now wanted only half a second of noon. The bell was about to strike, and it was a matter of absolute and... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.